The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the Internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
Well, what I was starting off to say is that in that handout, again, the question is how much information to give you in what form. You're probably best not to look at that handout, I don't know, until midway through you get bored and confused. But what I was trying to say is I'm so thankful for you guys hanging in there until 4:30 for this presentation. And I haven't presented on this class before. I've been teaching this class for 10 years at the Geneva School in Winter Park, Florida. And it has, I've poured lots and lots of sweat into it, and I really enjoyed it. It's been delightful, and in some ways symbolizes so much of what I spend my energy on. And it's spun off a lot of other ideas, and I've spoken on all these other ideas for 7 or 8 years now at different conferences and schools. But I haven't actually talked about the class, tried to condense it down into an hour, which has been quite difficult. You guys have had a few folks precede you over the past 3 weeks in this endeavor. There are some people that are trying to institute this class, the Scientific Revolution class in Lakeland. And so the teacher there came up for a day, and it was like 4 or 5 hours, that we spent together. And I think, hopefully he got a picture of it. And then we have a new teacher coming on that she's going to teach a second section of this class. And so I did this again with her the following week, and we got it down to about 3 hours, I think. So hopefully now we're going to be able to get it down to the 54 minutes that we have left, right? And with time for questions, let's see. But it's a difficult decision for me to think about how to give you all the content, because there's so many technical things that I could tell you, different iterations that I did from the second year to the third year, the fifth year to the sixth year. But there's, I think a lot of people just have questions about what are you even talking about? Why would you do this radical change in a science class, a science curriculum? And so I've decided, and perhaps this will move a little bit off of the outline that you've been given. I don't have the outline in front of me, come to think of it, but it'll be close enough to the outline, but a little bit different. And part of the reason I've done so is because I realize a lot of people actually would like to hear more of the rationale for why we're doing these things, so that it forms a more coherent picture. If I give you the how without the why, then it's hard to understand the whole of the ideas. So the Scientific Revolution is a class that's an integrated physics and calculus class, and it's within a narrative approach. And I told the session earlier that I had today that I was born in Detroit, Michigan, grew up in Tampa, went to college in Davidson, North Carolina, came back, taught math right out of college, then went to seminary. And out of seminary, I decided that I might not be called to overseas church planting like I originally thought I was, and considered what my calling might be. And as I was considering that and thinking about getting married, I started teaching again. And I found that it was a really great fit to teach in a Christian classical school, because what I got to see is how all of these teachers were trying to integrate their Christian faith into their curriculum. And for me, having loved math and science in college and high school, that was something that just never fit. And so I spent a lot of time then trying to think about how it fit. And it became my challenge to bring my seminary education back into the classroom and to sift through the categories. How did Christ make a difference in the day-to-day pedagogical in the day-to-day pedagogy of natural science and mathematics? So I think it's helpful also for you guys to know that I do teach this as an AP class for juniors in high school. So they take the AP Physics Key Mechanics exam at the end of the year. which is a physics with calculus, and it's very aggressive to do this. Probably not a lot of schools in the United States allow juniors to take an exam like this, so it's unique. But it's not necessarily the best approach to do, so I don't necessarily, we can talk about AP later on in the presentation. But so that you guys understand all the tensions that I'm trying to balance, I find that it's helpful if I tell you some of those things up front, so you know all the things that are going on. Well, let's start off with asking the most basic question, and that is, why mess with science? Isn't it great as it is? Well, our science classes do have much to offer, and especially at Christian classical schools, where we have wonderful and devoted science teachers. Now, some of the folks in the discussion about science and education say that what we really need to do is we just need to teach more math and more science to kids at younger ages so that they really get a feel for it. And they, when they get to high school, they can achieve mastery more quickly. And that's the driving force. Now, in Christian classical schools, I think there's another voice that says, no, we've got to kind of help them shape their imaginations. We've got to give them opportunities to play. What about literature and Latin? And so in Christian classical schools, we have this other voice that provides tension for us. But this is certainly a voice that's there in the culture, in the political spheres. The other teachers at other schools feel this and hear this, and the parents at a lot of our schools identify with this sentiment. Whether we feel it or not, this is certainly one of the topics, one of the ways that people think about natural science. So if that's what we were to need to do, is to, our teachers are pretty good, and we just need to teach it faster and at younger ages, then why mess with this? Why mess with a good thing? Well, I think it's helpful to think about what is at stake. And it's been difficult for me to formulate this, but over the past year, I've encountered some people that have said it better than I. And what they've pointed out is that students don't turn away from the Christian faith because of any particular fact that science gives. It is the form of the story that science tells that turns some to disbelief. So a particular fact, it's not because necessarily that they didn't believe in common descent when they were in high school, and then they believed in common descent when they're in college, and oh, now I can no longer be a Christian. It turns out when sociologists look at it and people look at it, it's not actually about any evidence. It's more about just kind of a general picture, a general worldview that science seems to suggest that students embrace in a way that feels like it doesn't allow them to be Christians anymore. Well, if this is the case, if science is telling a story, well, then our science teachers, the frontline storytellers. We're the ones that are telling that story, and we're the ones that have the opportunity to shape it. Yes, our teachers are. They are good, devoted people. In fact, the Christian classical school teachers are some of the best folks that I've ever met, some of the best teachers that I've ever met. So it's not them, nor sometimes even the topics they teach, that is at issue, but the unconscious form that science takes in most classes. It's hard to read, isn't it? Maybe that's a little clearer. I know it's small, too. By the way, I will let you know I've put this entire presentation, as well as the presentation from this morning session, up on a website. The website is called recoveringnature.org. It'll come up later in the presentation. But if you have trouble, if you don't want to take notes right now, you can find the whole presentation minus the embedded files on www.recoveringnature.org. The website might be a little slow at first, but it should be fine. This presentation will be under reimagining curriculum. There's a navigation bar on the left-hand side of the page that says reimagining curriculum, resources for reimagining, and then presentations. So our science teachers are the frontline storytellers, and we are the ones that have the biggest opportunity to make a difference in this problem. The problem with science like I said, is not what you think. James K. A. Smith says, and he wrote a book on Charles Taylor recently, and so he's going to quote from Charles Taylor. Charles Taylor suggests that those who convert to unbelief because of science are less convinced by data and more moved by the form of the story that science tells and the self-image that comes with it. The self-image that comes with it is that rationality equals maturity. Moreover, the faith that they left was often worth leaving. If Taylor is right, it seems to suggest that the Christian response to such converts to unbelief is not to have an argument about the data or evidence, but rather to offer an alternative story that offers a more robust, complex understanding of the Christian faith. The goal of such a witness would not be the minimal establishment of some vague theism, some notion of God, but the invitation to historic, sacramental Christianity. Again, I think the key idea here is that those who convert to unbelief, it's less because of science, because of some data that they identify, and they're more moved by the form of the story that science tells and the self-image of rationality equaling maturity that comes with it. Well, let's talk about some of the alternative stories that we could tell. When I first started at the Geneva School 12 years ago, before I was teaching this class, one of the big ideas that I said is, man, look, I've read Nancy Percy's book. Who here is excited about Nancy Percy on Sunday? Me too. I read Nancy Percy's book, The Soul of Science. It's a great book. Hey, we are moving beyond the warfare thesis, where we think of science and religion or science and Christianity at war. And that seems to be clearly established by the historians. The historians out there are content to say, yeah, that was from the 1870s, this idea of antagonism and warfare between Christianity and science. This thesis is taken out to trot every once in a while as a show horse, and people like Richard Dawkins like to pretend that it's a real big deal, that science and Christianity are at war. But none of the scholars take those guys seriously because they know it's false. They know that, in fact, that science was born within the cradle of Christianity. These are not at war with each other, and the scholars know it. The historians know it. The humanities specialists know it. It's just a few misinformed scientists like Richard Dawkins that think they can pull this out, and they can only do it with an uninformed public, not with anybody that really knows anything. And so the first few years of my teaching, I thought that we could focus on just science and Christianity are not at war, and that would be great, and the kids would love that, and that would help them move to the next level. But I realized that that's actually not a very, it's good, but it's not very positive. So students would go out and they, if they found somebody that said, oh, science and Christianity are at war, then they would be able to diffuse that conversation. But it didn't help them necessarily sustain their faith as much as I would have expected. Then the next 3 years of my own engagement as a teacher, I thought, well, let's look into the ways that Christianity helps to nurture science. And so we looked at the ideas behind the rise of natural science that are there going from the medieval to the modern period. Things like there is order in nature, and the order is, where does this order arise from, this mathematical order? So in a Platonic worldview, the forms are in the realm of the heavens, and that as the mathematical form gets put into reality, it never is as perfect as it was in the heavens. This is kind of the Platonic picture. But when Jesus comes incarnate, we get this sense that, no, matter is not evil. Matter is good. And matter doesn't have to instantiate ideas or form or logos imperfectly. It can instantiate it perfectly. And so Kepler famously talks about he looks for this discrepancy between the orbit of Mars, these 8 minutes that he's lost. He says, you know, the maker would not make something without perfection. It's got to be mathematically it's got to reflect this mathematical order. Whereas Plato would have said, no, it's all fuzzy. Kepler, because of his Christian faith, thought that creation had to exhibit mathematical order. And there are a number of things like that. The value that we put on the natural created world in Christianity, it's a garden, not a god, to use a phrase straight out of Nancy Percy's book, Soul of Science, which if you guys haven't read, please read it. It's a great book. I use it with the students every year. But the next 3 years, I thought about how Christianity has positive resources historically for the rise of modern science. And I thought that would be great. But here's what I found out happened. The way that people like Richard Dawkins argue, they don't argue this thesis too much either. They'll say, yeah, that's fine. Christianity did have resources. It's part of the story that Christianity helped birth modern science. But yeah, but modern science grew up. And then it didn't need Christianity. And so it shook off Christianity. And so now you can talk about Newton and Kepler and Copernicus being Christians all you want, but that's not relevant in the 21st century. That's not relevant in the 20th century, and surely not after Darwin. So that's the way that contemporary naturalists will kind of reject this. So then I think, okay, well, beyond the warfare thesis, okay, they're not at war. Christianity historically had resources for natural science, but that's not enough. Well, what we really need is that resources offered by Christianity are not just of historical interest. It's not just that Jesus Christ makes a difference for the people in the 17th century and how natural science came about. It's that if we look at a Christocentric lens, if we look at Jesus Christ as the incarnate Word, as the bringer of the gospel of grace, if we look at him as a member of the Trinity, these offer lenses today for natural science that actually add to the discussion. They simplify the discussion of natural science. They enrich the discussion today. Now, you can do natural science without them, but you're going to hit dead ends. And when you hit those dead ends, where are you going to go? Where are you going to go when you are in the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics and you no longer believe in reality? Well, now you're lost, and a lot of your natural science is kind of confused, too. And when you hit these dead ends, what I want you to remember is that Christian faith actually never told you to walk down that trail. There are resources here to understand the natural world, how God created it, in a more robust way than these things you picked up from your textbook. And this has been, now for the past 6 years, what's been animating me. And I've found this to be extremely, extremely fascinating. And so this is part of what I'm saying, is that there's a bigger story, and we need to start telling this story. The basic insight is this, that we begin by investigating our Christian tradition and our faith, but then we have to be willing to submit to it in order to understand it. Credo, ut intelligam. Is that a familiar phrase for you? Raise your hand if it's a familiar phrase for you. The phrase means, I believe, so that I may understand. I believe so that I may understand. And so we realized that a lot of, we just didn't actually take Christian faith seriously enough, and we didn't think that it was going to lead us anywhere when we did science. And moreover, the people, the Christians in previous generations that we talk about of the cause of the rise of science, we didn't think they knew enough. We thought, oh, those guys are probably misguided. They lived 200 years ago, or James Clerk Maxwell lived in the 1870s. He probably didn't know enough to be real smart as a Christian with new science today. And so we don't take our cues from them. We don't submit to their insights in order that we may understand. We just think that science is about up-to-date, you know, 2015 knowledge. And any knowledge that was had in the 1840s or 1850s or 1600s is irrelevant. But for hundreds of years, thinkers in the West held together our knowledge of nature and our knowledge of God. How did they do it? They did it through the liberal arts and natural philosophy. By looking at the rise of modern science, one can clearly discern the role of both the four liberal arts of the quadrivium, which some of you that were in this morning session might know are called what? The four liberal arts of the quadrivium are called the mathematics. Right? And you can see these four liberal arts, the quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy, impacting the rise of modern science. Moreover, they're impacting what's going on in natural philosophy. Natural philosophy was the name for science for 2,000 years, from the time of Aristotle until, until the 1870s, so longer than 2,000 years. All of these, the liberal arts and natural philosophy, were governed by theology. So they took their Christianity seriously, and they looked for ways in which the, for example, the Incarnation and the Trinity, was relevant to their knowledge of nature, their knowledge of science. And there's lots of these guys, like Leibniz and Pascal, that are just have tremendous insights that have been lost for 300 years, that, in fact, you'll find the best of natural scientists today being wanting to reacquaint themselves with these lost insights. Unfortunately, we, as pedagogues, as teachers, we still tend to think that we should be teaching science in a way that it was taught, you know, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago, and it's difficult for us. I mean, it's just frankly difficult. The resources aren't there to think about what's happening now in the cutting edge of science and how that some of that might comport better with Christian faith. Two lesser-known liberal arts that may be rightly discussed now when we're talking about the rise of modern science are astronomy and music. They're part of the quadrivial arts. So I said that one way that the medievals held science together with their Christian faith was through the liberal arts and natural philosophy. And one of the big stories is that these liberal arts, the four liberal arts of the quadrivium, the mathematics, are now becoming intertwined with science. Now, we tend to think of math and science as an inseparable pair, but that's just not true. If you think about a biology class, a lot of the biology class doesn't have that much science, or it doesn't have that much math in it, does it? I mean, it's a lot of nomenclature, and it's a lot of organization and systems. There's good logic in a biology class. I think biology is a science class. Few people would debate that with me. But, you know, a lot of my biology teacher friends shy away from mathematics. They don't love it. Now, they'll also say higher up in math in biology, there is more math to be involved. But on the other hand, you can do some serious biology without getting too deep in mathematics. But a lot of the story of the rise of modern science is the rise of the mathematicization of the world picture, the mathematicization of science. In fact, Newton's magnum opus was called the Principia Mathematica Philosophiae Naturalis, or the Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. So you can see this idea that he has, that mathematics is now going to come and become a part of natural philosophy. Kepler's life work, who is another key figure of the scientific revolution, was expressed in his Harmonices Mundi, or Harmonies of the World. Note here this idea of harmony in this, the rise of early modern science. Kepler was fascinated with the liberal art of music, and he corresponded with an instrument tuner about this. Guess who the instrument tuner was? Kepler corresponded with an instrument tuner of his time about different scales of music, and that tuner was Galileo's father, Vincenzo Galilei. Very interesting. The real story of the rise of modern science is about the scientific revolution is that these ancient mathematical liberal arts, under the aegis of Christian theology, it's about their transformation, how these ancient liberal arts transformed, and how they subsequently influenced natural philosophy, how the idea of natural science and natural philosophy became transformed by the mathematicization of the world picture. Now, the story must also include the mixed legacy of the mechanistic and atomistic worldview, which contended with the traditional Christian synthesis. So, we now talk about the Newtonian worldview, or Newtonian mechanism, the mechanistic worldview, or naturalistic materialism, or all those terms. And a lot of these do come out of the scientific revolution, with Galileo and Descartes and Isaac Newton talking about atomism. There are some very interesting books about atomism as claiming that atomism is at the heart of modernity, what causes the rise of modernity. So, this the the positive side of the story, I think, is how these mathematical arts transform natural philosophy. But then there's this also this warning side of the story that we have to explore, which is, what is the role of atomism? Now, some of you guys may know, atomism in the ancient world was always associated with... Stay up there. It was always associated with atheism. And so as they, one of the difficulties that these Christian atomists, these Christian mechanists had, was trying to figure out how to disassociate it with atheism and how to make it into a Christian philosophy. And so this has to do with the rise of mechanical law, you know, mathematical mechanical law, which is certainly a huge part of the story, but I'm not sure it's the only way to describe the story. So I don't know if they did a good job or not. I think perhaps they unwittingly capitulated too much. They gave away too much. They threw out form and purpose in their work, in the work of the atomists. And, you know, where do we end up in the 21st century? I think our culture has ended up without meaning and purpose. And part of that is the story of the scientific revolution. So I think the positive story is that, man, mathematics really transformed natural philosophy, and we've got to look at that. But then there's a negative side of the story, and that is how this atomistic vision of reality really became problematic. The story is not about just about physics per se, but about the influence of mathematics in natural science. Physics means nature. Physics means nature. But on the other hand, an integrated physics and calculus class, I think, is the most elegant way to reshape this narrative in a manner which respects the state of these two disciplines. So, if we need to tell a different story, but we also need to train our kids in math and science, I mean, because I certainly send out a lot of my students to become engineers and physics majors and doctors and things like that, or to study medicine. If we need to do both, we need to tell a new story, and we need to prepare them for further work in the discipline. I think that taking a look at this class, at these classes, are a great way to just rethink curriculum in the Christian classical context. So welcome to the Scientific Revolution class, an integrated narrative approach to physics and calculus. That was kind of a long setup. But the purpose is to try to help give you guys the why it is that we do this. Now, what I'm going to do now is going to be a lot more technical. And so now some of you guys may feel like, oh, well, that's what I was waiting for. And some of you guys might start to have your eyes gloss over. But let me start from the end. Instead of going from the purpose, now I'll show you where we get. And here, this is a note that I got from a student last year. I got it this year, and it was about the class from last year. Mr. Jane, this year has been a major stepping stone in my life. You have contributed so much to my decision of my college major and my life's work in the sciences. Touring colleges on spring break, I had a couple of interviews, and the class I shared with the most was your Sci-Rev duo. All the interviewers were impressed with the education and structure, as I am. I am very glad I had the opportunity to take the infamous, in a good way, Sci-Rev class. It's a hard class because it's AP. We'll talk about that later. Sci-Rev class at Geneva. Thank you for teaching me the harmonies and the connection between our physical world and the spiritual. This class has improved my faith, and having you as a discipleship leader has enhanced that as well. To future conversations and aspirations, it's up. And I think he wants to go into engineering. But it's kind of encouraging to get that, you know, from a science class. And I hope that other of you science teachers do get stuff like that too. But I just thought I'd share a little bit about where some of these kids end up. That was Isak. There's another one, Michael Reynolds. Now, Michael is he's off to Kenyon College, I believe. And like I said, I think he'll be an engineering major. Michael Reynolds is an interesting guy. He is now getting his PhD in Cornell in physics. And so he graduated maybe 5 or 6 years ago from this program, from our program. And this is something he did for the Courier, our Geneva newsletter. And I'll read you the first paragraph. As I considered the 3 years I spent at Geneva, I identified three formative effects on my schooling there that I've carried with me that have informed my decisions in college. First, Geneva inspired me with a love of the sciences. This may seem a surprising thing to say of a Christian classical school, a movement that is sometimes perceived to be stronger in the humanities than in math and science. However, it was Geneva's Christian classical attributes that changed the way I thought about science. As a young child, I was excited about science in the same ways that many children are. Dinosaurs in space are cool. Yes, they are. Over the years of my education, excitement about these subjects dwindled, dying slowly to a positivistic presentation that characterized science as the continuous, linear process of collecting more and more facts. Even at other Christian schools I attended, this model ruled de facto. Any romance or passion previously found in these topics was, for the most part, eradicated. For this reason, I entered high school at Geneva more interested in history and English than math and science. At Geneva, however, and especially in Mr. James' classes, I encountered a whole new model, one in which science could progress in leaps and bounds, or not at all, dependent on the worldview and cultures of those pursuing it. This understanding of science has not only been looked on with favor in higher education, but also enables interplay between science and other disciplines. More importantly for me, it permitted a relationship between science and faith that was symbiotic, not antagonistic or indifferent. And so I know I spent a lot of time talking to you guys about the story that science tells, but I think that's actually the issue, is that we are inadvertently telling the kids about a reductionistic worldview where there's always a right answer and where it's ruled by inviolable mathematical law, where God, we don't really know how he works these miracles, like, because he's kind of not in charge. It's really the mathematical laws that are. And so we kind of punt, as opposed to thinking about the Bible for our fundamental foundational views on these things, and then struggling to understand, well, what is the role of regularity in nature, mathematical structure in nature? So, I fast-forwarded. I just wanted to start from the end with some student comments so you can see where we're going with that. Now let's start from the end with what we do at the end of our class. We do a summative exam. Now remember, because it's an AP class, they have actually, by this point in the year, they've already taken the AP test. They usually take it May 5th or 9th or something. And then it's a double period class where I teach calculus / pre-calculus and physics. And because of that, we have two exam periods. We have an hour and a half for the pre-calculus test, and then we have an hour and a half that I can do whatever with. Now, I could have them do another physics test, but they've already taken their AP. So what I've chose to have them do for the past few years is to do a summative exam that reflects all of their learning, all the story that they've been learning over the course of the year. The summative exam reflects the process of the class, which is an evidence, reasoning, and narrative approach. Now, when I say evidence, it means like experiments on things like that, observations. You wouldn't call observational astronomy or the things of, you know, the data that you get about the periods of the planets, you wouldn't call that experimental, but it's observational. So it's evidence, and there's reasoning that you do to on that evidence or on those observations that connect them in new ways. Another thing that we do is you have to develop the calculus in that first year's class. So I have them reason to the concept of the integral. They have to reason up to the concept of the derivative. I don't give them the algorithm. They have to figure it out. And so there's a lot of reasoning, you know, proof, a lot of proof, mathematical proof in these classes. So the evidence is kind of the experiment side, the science-y side, if you will. So reasoning is kind of the logical, mathematical side, if you will. And then the narrative approach, which says that the poetic side, where there's always these worldviews and always these deep philosophical commitments, like whether there's mathematical order in reality or not. And that might be the big advance for example, in the 17th century. Not one observation, but a worldview advance. So the summative exam has all these components that I want the kids to be balancing. This is talking about the justification of their knowledge. In the typical situation, science class will give formulas and then ask the kids to apply those formulas on a test. You know, like a homework problem, with forces. You know, might have to hang a bird feeder and then figure out the 40-degree angle here and the, you know, what's the tension in this rope and the tension in that rope. Well, that's the application of formulas. It's not the justification of how you know those formulas are true. Now, my class still has a lot of application in it. You know, probably more even than I would like. My goal is to get that to about a 50-50 balance, where I've got about 50% justification of knowledge. So think about a mathematical proof as the justification for why you know that math is true. But then if you have to do 10 problems with it, that's the application. Same thing in science. If you reason up to, for example, Newton's three laws, then you've figured out why you believe and why Newton believed and why the community believed that Newton's laws were true. Now you can do 10 homework problems and apply those. Well, I think our textbooks and the way we teach science is all application. I mean, 100% application, where the justification, maybe that's too strong. Maybe it's 90%, 80% application. I'd like to see that as 50-50, where we're teaching the students how to think, because that's what justification is how you think. Now, and here's an interesting issue. If, let's say that one out of every three kids goes into a STEM career for my class, maybe even one out of every two. Well, what's the value for the other kids if they're not going to be applying these formulas? My goal is to help them learn how to think as well, right? And so if you want to help them learn how to think and how to reason through things and how to look at evidence and then discover patterns and order in the evidence, well, you've got to actually model that for them. Give them some time to let them struggle through that. So that's part of the story, the justification component. This is the nurturing of wisdom as well as work. There's no way that you can read this. And there was a way that we were going to be able to zoom in. But that was on my old computer, so I forgot. So I'm going to read this to you. Here is the first. This is the final exam for the Scientific Revolution class. Explain what happened. The first question is this. Explain what happened in the 17th century that is often referred to as the Scientific Revolution. Discuss its origins and central philosophical causes. Pay particular attention to the details of rational, empirical, and poetic advances, mathematical demonstrations of those, and how and why men like Kepler and Newton sought to describe the universe as a whole. And that's worth 50 points. And then the second part is a question about the atomism side. What are some of the good and bad consequences of the Scientific Revolution that linger in modern culture? Consider these quotes below by C.S. Lewis and his request for a repentant science. Interpret them and discuss any potential ways that natural science might heed C.S. Lewis's call. And then up below that are the quotes from C.S. Lewis, and they're put into a conversational form. So this was the exam, two big summative questions. Now, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to show you a student exam to see what they did. Now there is, let me actually shrink this a little bit. Okay, and let me see if this is Control H. My wife just texted me that she saw a famous person in a restaurant in Orlando. Carrot Top. Have you guys ever heard of Carrot Top? I'm like, Kathy, didn't you know I'm presenting now? I'll tell her later. She'll get a kick out of that. Yeah. So, okay, of course you can't see or can't read it. And that's okay. I wasn't necessarily expecting you to be able to read it. Although it is a little bit fuzzier than I want. What I want you to see is a couple things. First is that it's an 8-page response. and so she answered it backwards. She answered the second question first. You might be able to see the Roman numeral. at the left-hand upper side. And then she went to the first question. Because the first question was worth 50 points, the second question was worth 10. So she balanced her time wisely. Now, what you'll see here is a lot of prose. The rise of mathematical empiricism was the primary cause of the scientific revolution. So she's going to talk about kind of the role of the rise of the quadrivium and how the quadrivium influenced natural philosophy. She's talking about some of the precursors in the ancient world, Aristarchus, Eratosthenes. Then she moves to Copernicus, following Copernicus, Kepler. And then if you look, you'll see that she's got equations. This is the proof of Kepler's laws. Now, this is something that we did on a test, but actually, before we did it on the test, I gave them 2 or 3 days in class where they wrestled with the data that Kepler had in front of him, and I asked them, can you find a harmony within this data? And I didn't tell them what the harmony was. I didn't tell them what the equation was. I didn't tell them that T equaled K R to the 3/2 powers, which is Kepler's third law. I made them work to figure it out themselves. Very challenging, actually. This is towards the end of the year, so it's not the first time they've done something like this. But on this exam, she's got to recapitulate it within an hour and a half in a way that kind of ties it all together. These are the Galilean kinematics equations. Where did they come from? How did Galileo get them from his ramp experiments? These are, she's proving Newton's three laws, here from Galileo's kinematics equations. She's now coming to the culminating point of the class, which is the proof of Newton's universal law of gravitation. And she's shown that the force is an inverse square law that holds the planets in their orbits. But we don't have the full universal law yet. We don't get that until 2 pages later. And there's a lot of reasons why you can't immediately go to the universal law that are fascinating. But we never realize that if we don't teach math, if we don't teach physics in a historical context which respects the way that it actually arose. And we, what we do is we tend to give students the formulas, or we might demonstrate once we give them the formulas that interprets other evidence. But we seldom give the kids the opportunity to struggle with the data that the other people, that Galileo or Newton or Kepler, were struggling with, and to recapitulate that process of inductive reasoning, or what you might call abductive reasoning, or inference to the best explanation, where they're thinking through how we actually come to the conclusions in science. Some key moments of the class are the Galileo ramp experiments in the fall, where we do, they probably spend four or five days in a double period class doing. We read Galileo, we ask what he's talking about, try to discern his definitions, then they recapitulate these canonical experiments. And that's really fun. By proving Kepler's third law is, like I was just talking about, is challenging. It's a fun key moment. Some of the discussions of atomism are very foundational for the students. You can see how a couple of my alumni have responded, saying that they shaped their view of Christianity and science, because atomism is actually very problematic, and it affects everything today, from politics down to a marriage, I would say. Atomism is an incredibly important thing to understand, and science's role in that. One thing that I won't talk about anymore in this presentation is the discovery of the integral algorithm. That is a key moment in the scientific revolution class, and it is difficult to see the kids spend maybe 5 or 6 days struggling with how you get, how you come to the concept of the integral. Without me giving them, I give them the problem that they're working on. How do you find the area under these higher order parabolas? And I give them some sources, and we walk through the sources together. But they still have to do a lot of the struggling on their own. It's interesting, though, how it works, because they tend to work together and work in groups. These are formative moments. They're open-ended, historical, and it's kind of like guided inquiry. The students experience struggle and must wrestle with their own ideas, their own practices, their beliefs and habits. You know, some students are just attuned. In fact, many of us are attuned to thinking of science as recipes. You know, like you get the recipes, experiments might be kind of formulaic, but it's not just experiments. It's the way we think about science in general, where you kind of get the truth from somebody and then you apply it. And so they have these habits of thinking about science like that. And so when we put them into a situation where they've actually got to come struggle with the ideas themselves, you know, it makes them think about what new habits do I have to adopt? What kind of perseverance do I have to do? How do I attend to experiments differently? You know, one thing that I found fascinating, there was a girl that was really, whose mom was an architect, and she was better at designing experiments than a lot of the other kids were that had typically been good at science. And you see things like that, different kids having different strengths that come out. It's not always the ones that are just good note takers or that become the strong students. They also have, I often put them in groups, and the groups change, and they sometimes, if we've got a five-part problem, I might let them do the first two parts on their own. And then the first people to get to the answer might give them an opportunity to help the other students and think about what are the key steps without giving it away, and allow them to do some kind of the coaching, which is what I become. A teacher in this genre becomes a coach. And by the way, of course, I don't do this with every topic. I do this with a lot of my topics, and I try to do it with as many as possible. But and my true suggestion to you is to pick one or two for a first year that you might want to try to do something like this with. And over time, build your repertoire so you know how to do it better and better. I mean, it's a balancing act to figure out how I can get all this stuff done in a year. And I don't have a lot of time for homework because the other teachers have to give homework too, right? So as you think about how you would do this balancing act, I would suggest take one of these things, not all of them, and try to consider how you might introduce one. It's a task I think we need to do together, to be honest. That's one of the reasons why I'm talking about the class, is I hope that some of you guys will think about doing it so that we can do it together and collaborate. There are six key phenomena that we talk about in the class. Three of them are linear: a ball rolling on a table, a stone falling from rest, a mass on a spring. And then there are three rotational phenomena that we talk about in the class: the motion of the planets, levers, and pendula. And so we look at these phenomena all year long as kind of a way into the discussion and asking for what are the causalities? What is causing these phenomena? What's the common cause behind these phenomena? This is the concept of reasoning from phenomena to causes. It's experimentally oriented in observation and guided inquiry. This, by the way, is very Aristotelian, reasoning from phenomena to the causes of the phenomena. When we look at those six phenomena, a stone falling from rest, or a mass on a spring, or a pendulum, I don't know if any of you guys immediately recognize what I mean when I say the causes of those phenomena. Can anybody suggest what a common cause for a mass on a spring and a stone falling from rest might be? Force. That's right, it's force. Force is actually a cause. And this is very interesting because it took me 7 years of teaching physics before I realized this. But it's an immaterial cause. Now, it's not the only way to describe what's happening. Does anybody know the other way to describe what's happening? A stone falling from rest? If I drop a stone, there's a competing explanation for that most of you guys will know. Energy, that's right. The competing explanation was energy, that it's got potential energy that's converting to kinetic. Now, we're looking at the phenomena, so the phenomena are, the stone or the pendulum and its motion. Then the question is, what causes the motion? And it's these immaterial questions. Now, this was a big debate between Isaac Newton and Gottfried Leibniz. And in my opinion, well, most everybody thinks that Newton is the winner of that debate. But in my opinion, it's actually Leibniz. Because Newton championed this concept of force. But guess what Leibniz championed? The concept of energy. Leibniz is the originator of the concept of energy. He called it the vis viva, and in the 1700s, it has this big controversy, the vis viva controversy with force. But by the 1800s, it's clear that Leibniz won. Today, we don't talk about mass and force, we talk about mass and energy. And I think the Einsteinian tradition is all about Leibniz. Now, We don't teach that in our physics classes because we don't even understand that force is a cause. I did not understand that force is a cause. I didn't understand it's an attempt at a causal explanation, which is not the only potential explanation. Energy is also another attempt at a causal explanation. How can we have competing causal explanations? Now you can see we rapidly get into really deep philosophical waters. But I'll tell you what, these work in a science class. Moreover, there are opportunities to introduce a lot of points about Jesus Christ. I mean, and to talk about how these things are, there are immaterial aspects to reality. And even if we don't understand them perfectly, they're there and they're true. Now that is all fascinating discussion, but I'll have to save that for another talk because we are rapidly approaching the end. This, by the way, reasoning from phenomena to causes outflanks a key problem of modernity, which, if you heard me talk this morning, is solipsism. This idea that, oh no, I've got force and I've got energy, or I've got quantum field interactions, or I've got particle interactions. They can't both be true. Oh well, I no longer believe in reality. I don't know if you guys, any of you may have heard me this morning, but that was the same problem that Zeno had. He's like, oh, my reason is leading me to contradiction, therefore I no longer believe, it's all an illusion. I think this is actually typical of our age, that if you think of The Matrix or if you think of Inception, one of the key questions that these movies have is what is real? And one of the reasons I think we have it is the Academy has built up this system of rationality. It's very divorced from stuff, from looking at stuff, from looking at springs and pendula and falling balls and saying, hey, that stuff's great. These things are real. These animals are real. People are real. These are all great things. Now, what makes them tick? Let's think about that. Let's think about it together. We might have contradictions, but there's real causality in these things. And let's think about that. We're not going to fall for this, kind of division between ideas and reality that is so common in our period of modernity. So one of the great things about this approach is it does ground students in reality and helps them realize it's our causal descriptions of it that are finite and limited, not reality itself. Some key concepts and key questions, which we won't have time to dig into a lot, but if you were at my presentation this morning, you'll hear this term harmony again. Is there a harmony among the five terrestrial phenomena, among the springs and the pendula? Is there a harmony among the stone falling from rest and the levers? And what we find out is, yes, there are these causal harmonies through the concepts of force or energy that we can align these things so that we see how they're related and how they can interact. Is there a harmony within the motions of the planets? This is why we spend so much time developing Kepler's third law, because, yes, there is this deep harmony within the motions of the planets, T equals KR to the 3 house power. Now, here's the real moment of the scientific revolution, and that is when we answer the question, are the motions of the heavens harmonized with the motions of the Earth? That is a big question, because for thousands of years, the motions of the heavens, Aristotle said, followed one pattern, and the motions of the Earth followed a different physics altogether. But what they were discovering and what they were trying to bridge was that these were separate spheres. No longer was the supralunar sphere a separate sphere from the sublunar sphere. There was a law, mathematical laws, which I may have issue with, we could talk about another time, but they saw there was mathematical harmony between these spheres that they could be talked about as being submitted to a common cause. And this is really the insight of Newton's universal law of gravitation. Starting with questions allows the students to have mystery and to respect mystery. So we reason up to the universal law of gravitation, and when they encounter things where they realize that these two people disagreed, and yet they both have tremendous insights, it allows us to say, hey, look, there's truth does not exclude mystery but embraces it. And it offers a place for dialectic in our science classes. I think I'm going to go ahead and advance through a couple of these slides because these are good slides, the divine and natural mysteries, the Trinity, the Incarnation, and the Covenant of Grace, and the natural mysteries, the one and the many, form and matter, determinism, and free will. I'd love to talk about them more, but I want to get to the some practical questions that you guys might have. How do we do this? We've talked a little bit about what our story is, and I guess I don't have time to go through those, but let's talk about teacher and school preparation briefly. A teacher that wishes to do this must take it slow and just do baby steps. You should already have some experience having taught this level of physics if you want to try to do it in this narrative approach. It'd be hard if you were a first-year physics teacher to try to bring in all this narrative elements. And so what I suggest is to dabble in it and allow your students to dabble in it. Don't try to do it full on. A physics teacher who wants to do this must be willing to engage with the math. It can't be a merely conceptual physics, although the conceptual portion of it is very strong in this approach. And a teacher must be willing to read and learn and grow and be creative with curriculum. And it's good if you've got some support from other teachers. Students must recognize that this class might be different from other science classes that they've had. Another thing that's helpful is if, you know, what we've been doing is we've been aligning all of our science classes along these approaches. And so our biology class now in ninth grade uses a similar method of reasoning from phenomena to causes, a narrative approach. And so by doing so, this isn't the first time they've seen it. Students, let's just say this. If anybody wants to think about this, implementing this as an AP class, please see me first. It is very challenging. And I think sometimes it works against our purposes. So, yes, I do it at an AP level. I don't necessarily recommend it for everybody. If you really want to, I can help you, counsel you through it. But we also have often offered it as a non-AP class, and I think it's perhaps even more successful like that. So, some resources to do this. I told you guys earlier about the website, www.recoveringnature.org. If anybody is seriously interested in kind of going forward and trying to implement this, there's a school on the West Coast in California that thought about sending somebody for a year to shadow me what I do so they could implement it. There's a school in Lakeland now doing it. You know, we've got a couple sections. There are people around the country that are interested in doing this. If any of you are interested in doing this, what I'd suggest is that you email me and that we look for a few other schools to have a collaborative framework. RecoveringNature.org is going to be a collaborative framework for science teachers. And so you guys might, and as science teachers, you might enjoy seeing that. You can feel free to email me, and I can get you a log on to that, although most of it is public right now. I should mention that I did write a book that's called The Liberal Arts Tradition, and it's available outside at the Classical Academic Press booth. And it's not explicitly on natural science, but it covers a lot of the topics that we have covered today. But there's also another book on natural science that hopefully will be coming out in the next 6 months to a year that has a chapter on this class. So remember what is at stake, and let's tell a better story. Thank you guys for your time. And if anybody's interested, feel free to come up here and get some handouts. I'm happy to take questions, but it's the end of the day. So let me take 2 minutes of questions if anybody has them, and otherwise we'll come up and see me individually. Yes. Sure. Galileo, for example, in his kinematics, in the David Berlinski book, Tour of the Calculus, he says that instantaneous velocity is the key idea of the derivative. And so 12 years ago, I started to look into that, and I realized he's right. Galileo defines infinitesimals. And so if you look at Galileo's definitions, and oh, I forgot to show you guys some stuff, which is, here's a reader that we use. I'd be happy to give anybody, kind of a copy of this reader. Well, help you to get a copy of this reader in some manner. And so this is like we have Galileo in it. So when we read Galileo, then you can see the definition for essentially the derivative. So that's like an easy opportunity where we're developing the intuitions of calculus while we're teaching the physics, but we don't give them the algorithms of calculus, if that makes sense. They don't have the power rule for the derivative. They just have the idea of an infinitesimal in a ratio with another infinitesimal. Did that help answer your question? Sine theta equals theta, for example, is part of mv squared over r. So Isaac Newton needs centripetal force, so he needs mv squared over r. But how do you get to a sub c equals b squared over r, well, you need the small angle approximation, sine theta equals theta. So in Newton's Principia, there's a place where Newton actually walks you through the small angle approximation before he does mb squared over r. So there's another place, for example, where the derivative is applicable towards the proof of Newton's universal law. Again, in Principia, Newton brings out the calculus. So he's the great diagram of the integral, for example, in Principia. But of course, the central thesis of Principia is proving the universal law of gravitation. So by the way, we don't read the whole Principia. We read, I would say, about 30 pages of it, which is what Isaac Newton told John Locke to do. So I think it's a very effective way of reading the Principia. That's an excellent question. Are there any more questions? Yes. You're right. I'm not that interested in textbooks. I feel like, honestly, what I really would like to see is a community of teachers. If we, a community of teachers, were collaborating regularly so that we had enough material to, this is good enough as a textbook. And look, I should say, textbooks do good things, like in one sense, for the application side. So I'd rather just let those university professors write their textbooks on the application side, how we apply all these problems. But on the justification side, I'd rather be reading Galileo, Newton, and Pascal, and then we can write in the margins and help each other to write in the margins. And so there will be a couple books. I'm hoping this first book is largely written with collaborating with a couple other authors, which will give, again, the basic outline of scientific revolution. But and I'd be happy to write another one eventually to give more of an outline. But until then, I'd rather be working together as a community so that we can do this, figure it out together. Do you see what I'm saying? Because if this is going to happen, they're going to have to be able to look at all of us and say, goodness, these guys are doing something astounding. And if we do, it'll change the world. I mean, there's no question in my mind this would change. It would change the way everybody teaches science. And moreover, it would end the religion-science war. And I think people would stand up and take Christianity seriously again. Owen Barfield, friend of C.S. Lewis, one of the best friends of C.S. Lewis, said, there will be a popular revival when you cannot write a manual of science without reference to the incarnation of the Word. That's what we're talking about. So, well, thank you guys so much. I'd be happy to stay up here and field questions. I appreciate the ones you've given me. Thank you so much.
Put this reader up on the website. Okay, I'm going to put this up on the website.